Hello, everyone. Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the cricket podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. Our best way to do that is via patreon.com/goodareaspodcasts. But you could also do it on Super Chat. If you're on YouTube with us directly at the moment. Those are the two best ways to get the questions on this show. I don't think there's another way. No, you could mail them to me or, I don't know, get someone to write them down on little bits of toilet paper and put them through your cell block wall. That's a throwback, that one. If you did do it on Patreon, like Ellie did, you would ask, in your best batter list of all time, who is the best bowler? Callis. No, it's really interesting. I've been doing a lot of research recently on Garfield Sobers for a big project on him. And we really went through his bowling. I was kind of shocked to see how good his bowling stands up, for being honest. Way better than his average makes it look. He played in a lot of games where not many people took any wickets. We're comparing that to Callis, who's the other one on that list, but other great all-rounders as well. I don't think his bowling record, when you look at match factor, so when you look at his bowling average compared to the other seam bowlers in his games, which is a bit tricky for him because not always a seam bowler, and I'll get to that in a moment to fully explain Sobers. But when you look at his record overall and by match factor, he's actually like really good. And if you look at him versus, if you look at him versus pace or versus spin, he still comes out pretty good. So it's a confusing one with him because we don't really know how much spin or pace he bowled. Another thing is, I don't think I realized how much of a part-timer he was early and how he became a full-timer. So he basically starts bowling seam, 7 or 8 years into his career, and then he becomes an opening bowler. The other thing with him is that I think he bowls more than twice the amount of overs that Callis does. So the averages, I think, are 2 or 3 runs apart. But would you rather have a bowler who can open the bowling for you and well, then also bowl spin, then also bowl a different kind of spin if you need it as well? So the match factor for Callis is he's 4% worse than the bowlers in his game. So very good fifth bowler, like stunning fifth bowler. Sobers is above that. But he doesn't bowl his whole time, whereas Callis was a bowler his whole time. It's a really confusing one, is the best way of putting it. But if you ask me who I would prefer to have as a bowler in my side, I would go Sobers because you get the extra overs and you get the extra options. Right? He can be a matchup bowler for you. So yeah, I would do that. And it's a weird one. Don't get me. We went very much down the rabbit hole of that. In fact, I think I've now seen it because Eek saw me doing some of the research on this. And Eek has a question for Freaky Cricket, which I think is who's the better bowler, Callis or Sobers? And it's not an easy question to answer. Preston says, may I please have a link to the Discord? Okay, so we'll put a link up on the Patreon every couple of weeks to the Discord channel. For those of you who don't support us on Patreon, anyone who supports us on Patreon gets access to our Discord channel, which we have, I don't know about, we have like an international chat, a franchise T20 chat. We might have domestic cricket as well. I think there's that. There's all these different things. There's a stat section. There's if you want to ask stuff about good areas, if you want to ask me questions directly, all these different things come up available to you, recommendations for other people. I think there's a cricket. Maybe the funnest part of the Discord channel is there's a bunch of people doing cricket drafts. So there's a whole section for cricket drafts at the bottom. And it's really high quality. Like watching it, I've been really impressed with the picks and everything. I don't think I've seen the last ones as much, but I saw one of the, they asked me to look at one of the others and I was, yeah, really impressed with what they had. Sanjeet says, Ashwin has 28 less test matches and 49 less bowling innings than Lyon. I don't see any reason for Ashwin to not have more test wickets than Lyon had India played him in more overseas conditions. I believe Ashwin's skill level is much higher than Lyon's. Yeah, everyone thinks that, Sanjeet. Lyon thinks that. I don't think I've ever come across anyone who doesn't think that that Lyon is more talented than Ashwin. I don't think Lyon was more talented than Swan. The only thing I would say is that Lyon had to play when he was young and learning, and Swan basically only played test cricket when he was at his absolute best. There is an element of that, but even within their peaks, I think Swan is probably still a better bowler than Lyon. But Ashwin runs across Jadeja, who is also a great bowler. He's not as good as Ashwin, but he's a great bowler. And he's a much better batter. So I think with all those things, coming up, that's the reason that Lyon didn't play more in overseas conditions. I saw Kumble's comments about this, and Kumble's right. Ashwin should have played more overseas. But unfortunately, that's not how cricket works, right? Adam Gilchrist probably should have played more tests for Australia. But Ian Healy was a hard person to shift out of that position. I'm trying to think of someone else. We see sometimes in these sorts of situations that a great player just can be, if it's a single, another, you know, if you're a great seamer or a great batter, there's probably multiple spots available for you at any times. If you're a wicketkeeper, if you're a spinner, those things become a lot harder. Kartikeya says, always wondered why it was the case that a player of Brad Hodges' quality did not play more Test cricket. Was it because Australia had a stacked batting lineup? Would he have made the current Australian Test squad? And if yes, where would he have batted? Oh, it'd be weird. Where would he bat in the Australian team? Because he's probably a four, isn't he, or a five. And those are the two positions that they have. Look, the thing with Hodgie, and obviously I'm a friend, so I don't want to slag him off too much, but watch me slag him off. I think the thing with Hodgie is that there was a lot of very, very talented batting coming through at that point. So if you look at that, the part of his career when he should have played, you could have made an argument perhaps for him to come in later when, you know, that sort of Marcus North period. Like, Marcus North is a really good bat. I don't think anyone thinks Marcus North is a better bat than Brad Hodge though, right? So I do think that had he stuck around and not sort of moved towards T20 cricket, which made a lot of sense, he might have got some late career runs. Like, you're talking about a guy who played until he was, what, 45, 46? Like, he was really old, Hodge, and still playing well. Like, we were joking when he was coach of St. Lucia that he might still be a better bat than most of the players on the side, right? Like, if he just came in without any practice, he would have been at the same level or better than some of the other guys. In fact, I think it's what bothered him as a coach at times, because he knew that he could have done that. So I think that was an issue there later on when he became a T20 player. So I think if he played later, he could have had like an Adam Voges-like career, whereas he probably sort of moved on a little bit from first-class cricket because that wasn't where the money was, right? And he was getting paid a lot of money, and he was, you know, important player in the IPL and other things, you know, important squad member. When he was at his peak as a batter, I think they just had other guys in those positions. So they had Hussey, Ponting, Clark, all playing at that point when I think Hodgie was at his absolute best. There was a feeling around Australian cricket that he was a little bit tentative outside off stump early on, which he was. I don't think he was always a particularly good starter. If you watch him in T20 cricket, he would quite often do what Chris Gayle would do. He would start really, really slow. Once he was in, he was anything. But I don't think he was a good starter. And this rumor sort of went around. But I just think it was that there were so many other players for those positions. The other thing that he had was he came on, I remember when I first watched him play, he must have been like 17, 18. And he had this incredible first year of Shield cricket, but he didn't, a bit like Mike Hussey, he didn't go on to play great year after year. He was dropped from the Victorian team, for a while. And when he came back, he wasn't particularly that good. And I think when he got really good, that sort of period from, I would say, what, 2004 to 2009, there were just many other options available. We know how good he was. He made a double century in a test match. There were just other players. Sometimes that's what happens. Aditya says, just watch the video on who is the greatest active fast bowler in test cricket. Loved it. Based on the numbers shown in the video, would it be fair to say that McGrath is the greatest test bowler of all time, closely followed by Steyn? Fascinating, Aditya. I think we will look at this more. I'm going to have to do a lot more work on this. You're basing it on two metrics. You're basing it on match factor and strike rate factor. So match rate factor compares you to the average within your games compared to the other seam bowlers, and strike rate factor compares you to the strike rate of other seamers in those games. They're very good metrics that can be warped. So they can sometimes be warped by really good Asian bowlers, really good Asian seamers, for instance, because the second and third best seamers in those lineups might not be that good. If you're Imran Khan or Jasprit Bumrah, you're going to get you're going to get a big boost on some of those. You then also have, if you're in a great bowling lineup and you have other great bowlers around, your match factor sometimes can get limited. So we see this a lot with match factor for batting. I think the sort of the Weeks, Woolcott, Sobers, Kanai guys were ones. All the Australians from the early 2000s that we just mentioned before, another lot. And all the Indians of that same period is another lot, where there's too many batters making too many runs. So it doesn't make you pop as much on match factor at times. So in order to do that, you have to look at everything. Having said that, Aditya, what is incredible is that Glenn McGrath had Jason Gillespie, who also has a great match factor, and he had Brett Lee, and he had Damon Fleming, and he had Paul. Like, he had a lot of bowlers with very good records in his sides, and he still pops like that. The other one, even more so for Dale Steyn, is those were pitches where there was quite often, you know, a lot of wickets taken. Mackay Rantini is on there, and he still pops. I would have to do a lot more work. I still think you have to factor in, especially with seam bowlers, the first change. That's just seam bowlers as well, so we would have to have a look at spinners. And match factor is a little bit trickier. You'd also have to have a look at how good they were at home and away and how they travelled. But I was with you. When I saw that with Glenn McGrath, I was like, that's ridiculous. How did he manage to do that with Gillespie and Lee and Rifle and Fleming bowling at the other end? And I know they didn't always, you know, and Kasperwitz and Bickle, like Colin Miller's brief career. I don't know if we count him. I have to ask Varun if we counted him as a seamer or not. But you know what I mean? Like, what? But yes, I think that's what I noticed, McGrath and Steyn. I already knew Steyn would pop on that metric. I didn't realize McGrath would pop as much as he did. And I've been pretty careful on them. I'm pretty much a big fan of, like, a lot of people overlook McGrath. I still don't really understand why. Gaurav says, in supplement to the influence of politics in Indian cricket, anecdote by Nikhil Naz, Nagpur Green Pitch in Border Gavaskar 2004 was a result of an internal struggle between Sharad Pawar and Dalmia, which gave the BJT to Australia. Sharad Pawar, who would later go on to be BCCI and ICC president. I have to say, SM has restricted interference. Is that the Supreme Court? Does he mean that? Interference of politics in cricket, and there are a lot more voices who ask uncomfortable questions. SM. Oh, Shashank Manohar, does he mean, perhaps? I think when he was around, it was quite different. If that's who you mean, and I'm not sure you do, Gaurav, but if that's who you mean, I think it was a little bit different then. Look, you go through stages of these things, right? Like, we go through stages where, you know, in the UK, where it's very hard to get politicians to talk or think about cricket at all. And then there are other stages where, I think when the Conservatives were in charge for a long period of time, cricket was a big... Labor didn't want to talk about cricket, right? Because it's seen as a middle-class and above sport. When the Conservatives got back in, you know, I was asked to speak on two or three different issues. I think I only ever did one because I just... They were bullshit, right? But I had, you know, lots of friends who went in and did those sorts of things as well. I didn't really want to hang out with a bunch of Tory politicians, if we're being honest. You know, Liz Truss, was it Liz Truss? No. Theresa May, sorry, gave boycott the knighthood, which was quite full on, you know, considering his past and everything else as well. So you have periods when there is more political interference, and that sometimes can be what kind of power does the person in the chair have. So you're right, there have been times in India where it's been massively, like, way more, you know, and we've seen that in Pakistan. There are times in Pakistan when Imran Khan was in charge, it was a much more actively political situation, and we've seen that in Sri Lanka as well. We've seen that in Zimbabwe, like Mugabe, you know, John Howard, Malcolm Turnbull are more interested in cricket because they are literally more interested in cricket in Australia. And so they become a bigger part. So I do think there is different times and it wavers. But yeah, we've certainly seen a bit of a throwback towards that. All right, let's just have a quick... Oh my God, I've got so many questions today. Is that possible? I've got 42 questions. No. All right, let me go through a few. Ian Price says, recent wagon wheel and players better than their numbers brought up Graham Gooch, who was much better player post 30 than pre-30. Most recently for England, Alex Stewart, Graham Swan, Jimmy Anderson are probably three more very good examples. That's two batters, a keeper and a spinner and a seamer with no obvious pattern. Do England have more than their share of late bloomers? And is there a way of predicting it? I would have to go through. I always felt that England and Pakistan were two teams that were very good at sort of keeping older players around. Pakistan's, I've never quite understood because of the whole, their age thing is, you know, already off the scale. One thing we would talk about a lot in Australian cricket, and we would talk about it as a strength, but it can also be a weakness, is that in Australian cricket, if you are 28, 29, and you hadn't made it in Shield cricket, there wasn't enough money to stick around. And so you would disappear. And so the next young players would come through. In county cricket, there's plenty of money to stick around. But the flip side of that is you can get good later on in your career. So someone like Graham Swan, maybe in Australian cricket by that age, is goes off to do something else with his life, right? Where it, and I'm talking more traditionally, not so much now because there is money in Shield cricket, but more traditionally, you would go off and do that. And so I think that's a part of it. The other thing I would say about English cricket is think about how many games some of these players play. Like if you look at first class records for English players, unless it's like a player who plays county cricket almost every year and plays in their own first class, the England players always have so many more games. They play in so many more environments and examples and you know match situations than anyone else does. And that's why we call it a finishing school. You talk to the players and they'll say, look, it's really good. You know, there's professional at this county and all this sort of stuff. But the thing that was really good for me is I played 15 games. And it would take me two seasons back home to play 15 games. And I played them all in a short period. And then I had to go and chop and change and learn about white ball cricket, right? And all those sorts of things. It really is quite important. James says, why do Pakistan persist in believing Salman Agha is a frontline spinner? I don't know if they believe that he's a frontline spinner, do they? Let me just quickly bring up his record. He has played 19 test matches and he's bowled in 28 innings. That's pretty healthy. 17.66 is the amount of balls he's bowled in 28 innings. Bowls about 10 overs. So I'd say that's probably more of an all-rounder's level, James. There are some games when he plays as the only spinner and they do probably flog him a little bit more to death. You're right, he hasn't taken the wickets. And if you look in first-class cricket, I think they're probably over-bowled him. But I don't think they've played him as a front-line spinner. I think they've played him as, we're not picking a spinner, and so this guy's going to bowl front-line numbers. But it is incredible. He's above Carl Hooper on the bowling averages, I would think, at the moment. He was one of my favourite front-line spinners, not a front-line spinner. Cam says, is Australia's all-time test bowling lineup now clearly Warne, McGrath, Lilly, Cummins, or does someone like Davidson, Limwell, Spofforth find their way in? Davidson's a really interesting one there because he has one of the lowest bowling averages of all time and also gives you a little bit more batting than Lilly or Cummins, although Cummins is closer to the Davidson era. Limwell is up there as well. I don't think I have a huge issue, Cam, with your four. But Davidson, Linwell, and O'Reilly is probably the other one that you would look at. I don't think O'Reilly can push Warne out, if we're being honest. But just because he didn't take enough wickets, unfortunately, because of the war. And he didn't play in enough places and all those sorts of things. I think McGrath is automatic. Cummins is automatic at the moment. I want to see him over the next couple of years, although he looked really good in this series. So I'm not too worried at the moment. And I think Lilly, Davidson, Linwell is an argument that you can have. I'm going to say that it'd be very interesting to see how Hazelwood's next 3 years go. That would be the other player that I'd be more interested in as well. Nicholas says, what to make of Rod Marsh? He's probably best known as a fairly standard traditional wicketkeeper who could hit out a little bit in the lower order. Yeah, he's very good in ODI cricket. But his early first class and test records are very good for a keeper of his era. After 9 first class seasons, he had 7,000 runs at 35 and he hit 4 first class runs in 9 matches. So I talked to Ian Chappell for the book. Was it for the book? No, I think it was for the book. And we were, and he was talking about Rod Marsh. And I think Australian cricketers kind of thought he was much better than we saw of him at test level. I won't read your whole question, Nicholas. It's great, but it's a bit too long for me to read. You got to keep my dyslexia in mind a little bit here. I'll end up, doing it. But you basically said, was he Gilly before Gilly, or at least Haddon before Haddon? I think he's probably more Haddon before Haddon. And I think in ODI records, I you know, Varun might have looked him up before, but I would say that based on strike rate alone, he was probably massively underrated as an ODI player in his period. And he was used as a real, like, slogging option. And you go back to some of the games where Australia was really struggling, Rob Marshall pulled them back into it with just fours and sixes. So I think he's probably, you know, I think he's worth a lot there. I also think a culture and coaching thing really matters with him. I think he really set the tone of what Australian cricket was going to become. First, as a player and vice captain, and then second, as the person from the academy. So I think he probably has a bigger impact altogether. But yeah, I would, without doing match factors and strike rate factors and all those sorts of things, I would wonder if Rod Marsh wasn't similar in his career to what Haddon was. I think that's probably fairish. James says, what could Zafar Ansari's ceiling have been if he hadn't quit the sport? Look, I watch a lot of him play. I don't think he was like a potential great loss or anything. I think he was, I watch, it's my local ground, especially in those days. I lived around the corner. Like, I would go down to the Oval all the time. I never watched Zafar Ansari and thought, this is an international player. I thought he was lucky to get his call up. I think he was a very smart player, obviously, and made the most out of himself. But I think we actually saw the best of Zafar Ansari. All right, let's have a quick break here. So many ads, questions. I can't even find my ads. Yeah, let's have a quick break here, and then we'll be back in a few minutes for more of the Wagon Wheel. As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year, and I loved every part of it, except for one. This little evil pin here. Because I needed this to change my SIM card, and when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, or one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, or one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally. All right, welcome back. Sorry, I realized I accidentally pressed too long an ad there. Preston says, what are the top five T20 franchise leagues in your opinion? IPL, SA20, PSL, Big Bash 100. I don't know where the CPL rates anymore. CPL used to be quite high. I don't do as much cross and league stuff, which when I was an analyst, I did that a lot because you had to know if you look at someone's stats and whether they stood up or not. And they didn't always stand up. Whereas now I don't look at that as much. But those would be my top six. I'm not sure which one I would drop out of it. PSL, IPL is like up here and the rest are way, way lower. I don't know. Aditya says, assuming that both would have normal careers, whose peak would have been higher, Mohammad Asif or Ryan Harris? Assuming they both had normal careers, I'm going to go Ryan Harris. And the reason is he has a lot of the skills of Mohammad Asif, but he's faster and he can bowl bouncers. He can bowl you genuine scary bouncers for two, you know, a couple of spells at a time. So I think he would do that. Having said that, like, Asif's ability to work out new places and new methods is unrivaled. So I don't think there's much between it. But it's always that was always the big Ryan Harris versus Vernon Philander conversation. It's like the big difference is proper bouncers. It's not that Mohammad Asif couldn't bowl bouncers, but I don't think he's the sort of bowler who would be able to bowl like three overs of scary bouncers. He can bowl you a nice surprise bouncer. He had a decent bouncer, but you're not too worried about facing it ball after ball. Whereas I've seen Ryan Harris, you know, really do that sort of stuff. So that would, it's just for me, even if, as if average slightly lower, Ryan Harris gives you slightly more versatility, I think is maybe the best way of putting it. Cam says, Boomer's injury in Sydney was a blow for the series climax. Does it prove the value in a long series of making the opposition strike bowler shop again and again? I probably expressed that poorly. Yeah, no, essentially what you're saying is, like, tiring people out is a good thing. It's always existed in Test cricket, right? The difference is in the old days, bowlers knew that that's what batters were doing. And sometimes they would come on and they would bowl a spell at 80% speed, right? Because they're like, this spell doesn't really matter to the game at the moment. I'm going to keep it tight. I'm going to make sure we don't go for too many runs. I'm going to do that. And then you would have captains go up later on. And this still happens in first-class cricket. I go up later on and go, now I need the real spell, right? We don't do that anymore in Test cricket because the speed gun, everyone will be like, oh, he's not fit, or oh, he's tired, or why doesn't he bowl at that pace anymore, and whatever. Bowlers just don't do that anymore. And so it's actually, I think it's easier to tire out bowlers now more than ever before. James says, traditional nations of how to construct a red ball batting order appear to have been upended in recent decades. Case in point, what is it about Sam Constance's games that make him so well suited to open that any other Aussies, than any other Aussie bat in the top five or six? Is there a method to the apparent madness, or is it suck it and see? Well, it's because he was opening the batting and making runs domestically, and they weren't. That's the reason he's opening. What you watched in the Test series is not exactly what Sam Constance has been doing in first-class cricket, right? That first innings was the second quickest innings he'd ever played in whatever it was, 18, 19, 25 innings. So part of it is you're reacting to what you saw in the Test matches. That was... Sam Constance was basically thrown in as a decoy for Bumrah. And to be fair, it kind of worked. The other guys aren't openers. And so you have a guy who's an opener who has been making runs domestically and you throw him into the Test side. I would say that's the more normal one. The weird ones are Jacob Bethel and Tristan Stubbs batting at first drop. Those are the ones where you're just like, wait, what? So no, I would say Constance is a much more normal one. Ellie says, rumors of two divisions again. How would a two-tier system work without dynamic promotion relegation? It doesn't work without promotion relegation. I'm afraid it'll turn into a Super League. Yeah, if they do that, then that's basically the end of Test cricket as we know it. And that would be the worst possible situation. I can't see... There's an easy way of doing this, Ellie, right? Which is... So the original two divisions were seven teams in Division 1 and seven teams in Division 2. You could make it eight teams in Division 1 and eight teams in Division 2, and I don't think anyone's going to worry about India falling out. Also, the interesting thing about the broadcasters thing is that that's only if you sell it as a package. And I don't believe, unless that they're going to be able to get that through, because if you sell it as a package, what you're actually doing is you're taking away power from Australia, India, and England. Because they have the power at the moment because they have the three biggest TV markets. So I'm not sure the broadcasters would be too worried about that. But Indian cricket would obviously be worried because they would make less money if they're playing Netherlands and who else would be in Division 2? Ireland and perhaps Scotland or whoever else, right? Like, you know, Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, those teams. So that would be an issue. But you could make it eight teams. And I don't think that would matter. But there's a long way to go on this. Naveen says, does Bumrah getting injured in the final test affect his future captaincy prospects, given his unorthodox action, the talk about managing his workload? I think it's the same question we had with Cummins. And Cummins was fitter. Like, Cummins has actually missed a lot more test matches than Bumrah because Cummins missed like 6 years of test matches, right? But he was probably, once he got back to the test team, more robust than Bumrah has been. But it's the same question you have with any fast bowler, right? Outside of Courtney Walsh, who never got injured. Which is, what happens when you get injured? What happens when you need to be rested? I don't think this changes it because this conversation was always going to be part of it. That is part of the decision. Whether it happened or not, I don't think that changes the conversation. Jane says, what exactly is mystery spin? How do mystery spinners differ from traditional off or leg spinners? It's a stupid term, Jane, I think, at a certain point. Because we use it a lot when actually what we just mean is that player has a wrong end and no one's picked it up yet. But if you want to go back traditionally, what you were looking at is Iverson, Gleeson, And then I suppose you would put Saqlé Mushtaq in that, but we didn't. We put Paul Adams in that, partly because his action was so weird. Murali was probably put in it briefly, although he didn't seem to, we didn't call him that often. It's essentially just non-traditional spin, if you really want to know. So Jack Iverson would flick the ball out the front of his fingers, which was Karen balls. Gleeson then did the same thing after. We have Jack Potter with the Dusra in the 1960s in the Australian Nets. You know, could do that as well. So there was a couple of bowlers in that period who were doing that. Then you get the Karen ball again with Harath, and then everyone else sort of bowls it after Harath does in the late 90s or whenever it was he was first bowling it. And the delivery that the Dusra becomes proper with Saqlé Mushtaq and everyone starts to learn it. So you could say that Warner's mystery spinner, right? Because the flipper is a part of it. It's just kind of a catch-all for all different kinds of spin that isn't traditional. And it's become a bit of a lazy term. Like, we probably need a better name for the Varun Chakravarti, Mujib Alasan, Tikshana type spinners. They are probably now a version of spin on their own, which is probably, we probably could call them Karam spinners, even though that is not even their default ball. It is the ball that probably brought them in. And that's what Gleeson and Iverson were in Australia as well, all those years back. But we're now getting to a point where it's a bit more muddled. Like, I was watching Sikandar Razza in the test match the other day, and he was bowling knuckleballs, but it looked like he was bowling wrongens at one stage, and he's bowling leg spin. So I think what's happened is spin has got a little bit further on, and we just need a name for every different, different chunks of that. And, you know, we've done a video, a podcast on Varun Chakravarti. I'm not sure if it's gone up yet. I think it has. A red inker, which was really interesting. And it's like, he's no longer even that sort of Karen ball bowler. Like, he now has multiple different balls that he bowls. And mystery spin is probably the easiest thing for a commentator or a writer to say, or a fan. Jane says, how come I don't hear much about Bert Oldfield in conversations as best wicketkeepers? I think a part of it is, Jane, because he's deceased. We tend to have some recency bias. He's got the record for the most stumpings in Test cricket, and it's gotten them in about half the innings. It's the next best, which would be Godfrey Evans. The record has been held for nearly a century now, and it isn't going to be broken. Were batting techniques against spin just poor in the olden days? Was he really surprised that in India and Sri Lanka keepers don't hold the record? Yeah, got to remember in those days, Australian wickets spun a lot more, and he had the two best bowlers in the world were spinners, and they were Australians. So I think that plays a big part in what Bert Oldfield did. With Clary Grimmett specifically, and I you'd have to go through the Clary Grimmett and Bill O'Reilly record, but I would assume with Clary Grimmett, he bowled so slow that people probably were forced to come out of the crease to him. And because they couldn't pick which way he was spinning it or whether he was bowling the flipper, that probably helped Bert Oldfield. Actually, let me look at the years of Bert Oldfield. I need to know his full... Bert Oldfield, so 54 matches. Where are we? So he starts in... Yeah, so he would have got... He would have played a lot of tests without O'Reilly, though. But he would have had Ironmonger as well. So there's another great spinner. Did they have another third spinner that I'm missing? So it was incredible. Australia's lineup of spinners in those days, you know, O'Reilly and Grimmett are great. Ironmonger was fantastic. You would also throw in Chuck Fleetwood-Smith. And I do feel like I'm missing another obvious one that I've forgotten there. So they did have a lot of spin options available to him. I don't know if that fully explains what you're saying. He still gets brought up. There's a lot of great older wicketkeepers. You know, Jack Blackham is another one that used to get mentioned a lot. Bob Taylor is another one who doesn't get mentioned a lot. Essentially, we have changed the conversation about wicketkeeping to being about batting. And old Bert wasn't particularly good with the bat. He wasn't terrible for a wicketkeeper of his time, but he wasn't good. MF Jim says, will the inner cricket nerd of Steve Smith be chuffed that he's the only batter to be dismissed in the 9999 O's and on 99999? I don't think that's one of the things that is would tickle Smith. Could be wrong. Person McPherson Face says, what do you think of the proposal to switch Test to a two-tier system? I've got no problem with it. I have said for ages it should have been a two-tier system. The minute the World Test Championship came in, it should have been a two-tier system. So I'm very pro two-tier system. What I'm not pro is there's no promotional relegation. I would go further, person. I would take it to a three-tier system. And then I would get rid of the designation that you have to be a test nation. I would say every test, anyone who wants to play international cricket over, you know, whatever the agreed upon amount of days is, can play a test match amongst themselves. And if you're good enough, you can get into Division 3 through some sort of tournament qualification system. And then if you're good enough in Division 3, you should be good enough to be in Division 2, you should be good enough to be in Division 1. I'll never back away from that. Like, it's ridiculous that we're in a situation where you can get your test status in, you know, 1877, 1890, 1928, and then keep it forever, and other teams who have been very good at various times can't get it. Like, for me, that just doesn't make sense. It's never made sense. I would never back a system that is like that at all. All right, but if it's a two-tier system and you can't go between the two, that's not a two-tier system. That's a Super League, and that I'm definitely not a fan of. All right, let's have a quick break, and we'll be back after this with more of this kind of thing. And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your two times ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win. MF Shim says, when it comes to doing a wrap-up of a series, is there ever a temptation to compare it to another series between the same teams? Towards the end of the series, I felt like it was some shadow of 2007-8 were creeping in. It's not like towards the end of the series I would do that. Like, I would either feel that it was happening and I would mention it, or I wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't search something out like that. Like, you know, we didn't really do a wrap-up of the series. We did Australia 1, and we had another big feature that should have come out weeks ago, but Cheyenne wrote it and I just didn't get time to put it together. And we never got it out. And I feel like at the end of the Melbourne test, I did a pretty good rundown of the series. So yeah, we don't even always do that. It's not kind of the way I think. Will says, really enjoying CrickPix. Thank you. If you haven't seen CrickPix, go watch CrickPix. I think the latest batch of shows have been excellent after a slight dip caused by confusion over the criteria in previous episodes. See, I think that's actually one of the best things, though, Will, because I think that's what it should be. Everyone should come in with their own thoughts on those. Anyway, on the batters being better than their numbers, I was wondering whether Brian Lara could be a shot. Yeah, I think that's another fair player. I think Lara should have averaged higher than he did. So I've got no issue with him being in that kind of conversation. Adityan says, what does Australia holding all bilateral trophies at the same time do to India's legacy? It's the strongest team of this generation. India is still probably the greatest team of the era, but it feels like you cannot make the unarguably the greatest claim like for the West Indies and Australia. Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues. One, when you finish your era, like another team should sweep you. Like that's the best thing about the West Indies losing to Australia in 95, right? Is that the best team knocked them off. Whereas that's not quite the case with Australia. Like Australia lost to England in that one series. Then that team sort of fell apart of England. Then Australia lost to South Africa. But by the time they lost to South Africa, they were no longer Australia. Like that's not as satisfying, is it? It's almost less satisfying as well that New Zealand beat India and then Australia beat them. But it kind of feels like this is the end of that era of the Indian side. But it's also kind of the end of the Australian era side. I'm not too worried about the bilateral trophies thing, honestly. I still think India was the best bilateral side of this period of time. Over a 10-year period, Australia can't compare, I don't think, to India. But Australia was a really good team as well. And New Zealand had a great period, right? Pakistan was number one at one stage. Like, there were some very good teams around. The Two says, has Scott Boland's role changed after this series? And how do you think Australia should use him? I think it's just getting harder and harder to ignore him. The issue is, how do you fit him in? Either they have to make a decision at home and Lyon just doesn't play anymore, or they have to make a decision that Mitchell Starc's left-armedness and bouncersness and being the fast bowler is more important than Boland's extra wickets. Those are the two decisions that they have to make at home. And away, look, I think they still like their normal four-person attack and knowing that they can drop Boland in at any stage. American Wickets says, as a big baseball fan, we have access to tons of data from StatCast, from Hawkeye cameras. For example, you can go through and see every delivery's break, spin, placement, etc. Why does cricket make their data less accessible for fans? Because you're not a baseball fan, American Wickets. You're a Major League Baseball fan, right? That's a league where they own all of their own data. In cricket, no one owns everything. Every different board has a different relationship with Hawkeye or whatever the other tools that they use. And so you have India. So Cricviz can't use India's darts from home India matches in their visualizations and in the information that they sell to people, right? Because India is saying, well, we don't want you selling information about Indian pitches to other people, right? The weird thing is that India don't, you know, as Jimenez should say, they probably don't use their Hawkeye data as well as they should. But that's what you have. And so no one owns it. Major League Baseball and the NBA are owned. They can make a decision to just release all the data tomorrow. Cricket cannot. There is no one in charge of it, all of these different things. The best way of doing that would be the ICC getting enough money to just buy up, you know, all their rights to all this and then release it. And it would help cricket as a sport. And as you say, it makes it more accessible. It also moves the game forward, right? Like all these great things. And as someone who has to beg, borrow and steal all of these kinds of things on a daily basis, it would just make my life so much easier. However, for the ICC to do that, the boards would have to give them more money and they don't care about this sort of stuff. That's where we are. MF Jim says, could Manus Abhishek be dropped for Cameron Green when he's fit? I can't see him going back to number six due to his style of batting, could work at three potentially. I feel like Manus worked his way through his issues at the moment, so it would be a weird one. Is it more likely that Green comes in at five and they move head to six in that situation? But I don't think your overall point is massively wrong, but I don't think they would do that. Satchmo says, why did it take so long for Clive Lloyd to settle on four quicks? In the Packer series, for example, spinner Padmore played the five super tests, Austin two. Lloyd only played three quicks in official tests versus Australia in 78. Not only did he not do that, if you go back, it's in my book, the Test Cricket, the Autobiography. That was the one where I was like, it actually takes forever for him to do it. Like, he would play medium paces and all-rounders, right? Like, it's really slow, and no one ever talks about it anymore. And I think it's probably the way that cricket was broadcast and talked about at the time. Like, you know, no one was following the West Indies. No one knew the West Indies were about to become the West Indies. Like, there's actually, it's incredible to me now that there weren't cricket writers who were, like, willing to, like, trying to make money off the fact that they were going to be covering the best side in the world. But no one did it. And it's quite a sad thing. And maybe they couldn't have done it as well. The way newspapers worked, I don't know. I don't know if there would have been enough money to be made from Australia and England, you know, the two major markets at that point. But I don't know why Clive Lloyd didn't do it. I have actually worked with Clive Lloyd. If I ever work with him again, I'm going to ask him and I'll forget. Rugis says, Bumrah currently averages 26 with the ball in England. After next summer, what do you think that number will be? I've asked this before, but will India be an average test team for the next two or three years? They're in transition. I don't think they'll be average. I think they'll be better than average, but I don't think they'll be fantastic all the time. Bumrah averages 26. I'd have to have a look at how many matches that is from everywhere else. But, you know, I'd be saying lower. I think lower is the best way of doing that. All right, let's have another quick break here, and I'll be back in a moment with more of this thing.
The scores were level. They just needed a conversation. Instead, the only time they met up was at the same end, and Australia would go on to win that World Cup. In Hit Wicket, you've got those game-changing special abilities at your fingertips. Need to accelerate the scoring? Bang! Activate 2X, and suddenly every boundary is worth double. That's right, a 6 becomes a 12. The opposition won't know what hit them. Or maybe you need to put the brakes on a high-scoring power play. No problem. Unleash the heck, and watch the batter struggle to even score a single run. In fact, they might even end up going backwards. It's absolute chaos. Look at the King of Spin, for example. But there's more to it than just flashy special moves. Every player has their own unique passive traits that add another layer of strategy. Gilly, for example, he's a seam hunter, a nightmare for any pace bowler. And Beefy, well, he's got a golden arm. The longer a partnership lasts, the more dangerous he becomes. Hit Wicket challenges you to think like a true captain. You've got to analyze your players, understand their strengths and weaknesses, and then use those abilities and traits to outwit your opponent. It is a real test of your cricketing brain. Now, if you excuse me, I've got a strategy to revise.
Josh's, what if when a test match ends within 4 days, the two teams do a friendly T20 on the 5th using a mix of teams? Surely the advertisers broadcasters would like that. I mean, that's how the first ODI started. I don't think you'd do an official one, would you? So a friendly one makes more sense. I think everyone just wants to, you know, everyone just likes days off, Josh, is probably the answer to why that wouldn't happen. I don't know how the broadcasters would feel about it because it's a friendly, but maybe. William says, do you have any insider information on what went wrong from Ollie Robertson in the England team? Fitness is the main one, if you're being honest. I still think if you had conversations with him, they would say he's the best new ball bowler they have. He's not fit. And I think that was a big problem. Also, a big part of their modern game is the bounces, right? And he can't really bowl. I know he's tall, so he can bowl some bounces, but you don't really want to put him in. But I think it's a combination of he couldn't bowl bounces. They didn't think he was really an all surfaces test bowler, and his fitness. I think it's probably a combination of all those from the conversations I've had. And I haven't had a conversation in a while. Like, he's no longer really thought of about that much. Ben says, what outside pressure was the Australian cricket team put under to make them behave so differently in 2018 against both England and South Africa compared to now, when the core of the team is mostly the same? How can teams' vibes be so different? What outside pressure was it? Okay, you're talking about the sandpaper thing. I think it was a toxic, and I've written about this before, I think it was toxic all the way down from James Sutherland. They got themselves into a situation where they well and truly believed that winning was the only thing that mattered, and that in order to win, they would do anything. I think that was pushed by coaches. It was pushed by general managers or directors of performance or whatever. It was pushed by Cricket Australia. Cricket Australia was, in that period, a very toxic place to work. You know, a lot of people I know who worked there were not particularly happy people. There was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of weirdness around that organization at that time. Not all of it was James Sutherland as well. It was kind of being split up because I think people were seeing that James Sutherland was going to be moving on as well. Like, you know, there were power struggles and everything else. But it was a really weird place. Like, you know, I visited it a couple of times, and as I said, I had friends who worked there as well. And like, the stories were horrendous. I can't think of another cricket board where I've ever heard those sorts of stories. And I think it was a toxic place to work at times. A lot of one-upmanship and everything. And that went all the way through to the team. But it's about the leadership. And I think one of the reasons you see the current team being quite different to that team that you're talking about is because the leadership of the current team. Andrew McDonald, I don't necessarily agree with what he said on Constance, because he was like, oh, you know, the Indian team made a thing out of Constance. I'm like, if you walk back to the with the bowler and say stuff, you're going to be singled out, mate. Like, you just have to handle that as a human being, right? Like, I don't care if you're 19 or 38. You've made the choice to make yourself the main character here. You're going to become the main character. Fine. I have no problem with Andrew McDonald worrying about his well-being and everything. That's fine. But don't pretend like it was the Indians who instigated that. Sam Constance instigated a vast majority of that sort of stuff. But look at what Andrew McDonald is talking about. That's not how Darren Lehman would have talked. It's not how Justin Langer would have talked, right? It's not how a lot of older Australian cricketers or coaches or leadership people would have talked. You know, remember when Marlon Samuels and Shane Warne got to the point where Shane Warne's throwing a ball at him and Marlon Samuels is throwing a bat at him. Go back and have a look at what James Sutherland wrote. I think that was the time where he said, it's not tiddlywinks. Test cricket's not tiddlywinks. He said very similar sorts of things to what Gautam Gambhir was saying. And he said that a few different times in when he was talking about it. You know, international cricket's not tiddlywinks. Or actually, he might have said for the Marlon Samuels one, oh, it was actually good for the game, which is like, even if they thought that internally, which they did, it's like, don't say that publicly because it makes you look like idiots. But there was another one. There was another moment where he said, Test cricket's not tiddlywinks and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, he came from the same cricket culture I came from, James Sutherland, right? Like, Melbourne cricket culture was quite toxic. It was quite full on. You know, those teams under Dean Jones and Les Dillman, like, there are a lot of cricketers who were scarred by that for life because they weren't tough enough for them. I think all that was coming through at that point. And I think Pat Cummins is, I haven't talked to Pat Cummins one-on-one since he was 18, 19, right? Actually, maybe it's 2021. I can't remember. But I had an hour-long sit-down with him at that stage. At no stage did I think he was the sort of person that would fit that kind of culture. And I know Andrew McDonald a little bit, like, you know, the odd direct message on Twitter. I had a couple of beers with him, maybe when he was with Bangalore, you know, stuff like that. Again, wouldn't say I know him particularly well. Neither of those people would like that. The one person I know within that culture quite well is George Bailey. Again, not that kind of person. So that's a lot of different leadership people involved and very important people. And, you know, I don't want to talk about Nick Hockley or some of the other, you know, chairmans and CEOs and those sorts of people. But I feel, again, from the, you know, I remember one of the chairs of Cricket Australia reached out to me not that long ago. And it turned out we grew up around the corner from each other. But he reached out just randomly about something I'd read to say how nice it was. My entire relationship with Cricket Australia has mostly been just like really angry phone calls, really angry emails, pulling me on the spot, right? Really aggressive stuff that no other cricket board has ever done, right? I can't think of another. That's why it's always funny when I'm told like how much I hate India and whatever. Like if you guys, like the stuff that's going on with Cricket Australia, I can't even talk about some of it, right? I'm really disappointed. I remember going to Cricket Australia and saying, we're filming outside the grounds because you guys won't let us inside to film and we are getting threatened with violence. And they didn't do anything to stop it. They did it years later. They eventually changed it. But like, you know, I've had to protect Mel Farrell from drunks, you know, people coming up and screaming, you know, sexual things at her face. I had a guy threaten to beat me up in Brisbane one time. Mostly Brisbane and Melbourne were the two places we had the biggest issues. And you would go to Cricket Australia and they'd be like, well, we can't let you in the ground because you don't have rights. It's like, and it's just like, I'm not asking to come in and film the cricket. I'm asking to film against a white backdrop somewhere. I just found it a really, really awful place at times to be involved with. It doesn't feel like that anymore at all. I think it's changed quite a bit over the last couple of years. And I didn't feel like every single person was like that. But so if you put that together with Bailey, McDonald and Cummins, and you start to look at the way they are, you know, look at some of the other people they've got involved with them, you know, even again, people like Dan Vettori. It just feels to me that they've made a conscious effort to change the sorts of people that they have hired. And I won't go through all the chairs and CEOs and everything else because they've had a bit more of a flux than they did in the old days. You know, the chair wasn't that important before. James Sutherland was like, he was basically the chair and the CEO at once, right? That's how important he was there. And so they've had a few different people come through, but I just think there's been a change in general to the way that they think about things. And before, I think it was a little bit more hyper-focused on winning everything. They wanted to win, like you'd write an article and they wanted to win the argument with you about the article. And I'm like, well, it's already published. Why do you even care? Like, it's gone. Like, if you want to have a friendly chat with me about it, it's fine. But why are you trying to, you know, it didn't make sense. So yeah. Bloody Bugger says, recently you mentioned that 1948 Invincibles is potentially overrated in comparison with other GOAT teams. What other cricket hot takes would you cause a storm in papers if they were published 50 plus years ago? Yeah, I think the other one is the South African team. Those are the two teams. You're just like, really? I think there's a lot of great players who have coasted by and were absolutely shithouse overseas. I want to say Dennis Compton averaged mid-30s, maybe it's slightly higher than that overseas. A lot of great Australian players. I think there's a couple of West Indians. You know, the whole Walcott Weeks. Their careers are weird. I don't know if they should be... I think they are remembered a lot more fondly now because they have great overall averages. And when you break it down, there's a bit more of an issue there. I'm trying to think of who else. I mean, the Bodyline one, I probably would have got myself in trouble over Bodyline, right? I would have been like, this is a perfectly respectable cricket strategy. And the same with the underarm. Underarm would have been another good one where I would have been like, okay, well, why was this law never written? David Hook's running short, although David Hook's one never got that famous, but purposely running short. Like, how did it take until Kieran Pollard to change that law? I suppose the other thing would have been, I would have been probably advocating for Argentina to get test status, Denmark to get test status, Sri Lanka, the long time before they did, Bangladesh, probably almost straight away after their separation as East Pakistan, Canada, I probably would have given test, I would have been arguing for test status with. Yeah, I think if you know, but I'm a product of this generation, right? Like, would I have been like that back then? I mean, probably I would have, because there's something wrong with me, but you know, I don't know. Yashara says, I'm curious about players who reinvent themselves completely after turning pro. Mark Richardson becoming an opener after starting as a spinner. Johan Botha and Colin Minor becoming international spinners, changing from theme 1 year previously. How do they change so quickly? These are some of my favorite cricketers. Throwing Callum McLeod from Scotland. Azhar Ali. In fact, I'll try and get Azhar Ali on the podcast to talk about it one day. Yeah, I definitely want to talk to him, actually. That's a mental note. I'll forget that. Someone, Varun, needs to send me a WhatsApp about that, so I remember it later. I'm trying to think of some others. Sobers, that we were talking about before. Even someone like Ravi Shastri, like that ability to just continually improve. I think these are people who are desperate to be cricketers, and they have a lot of good cricket skills, but the skill that they had when they were 15 or 16 isn't necessarily the skill that is a test quality or even first-class quality in some cases. Like Stuart Broad's batting. At 15, his batting gets him a contract, right? By 25, who would want Stuart Broad batting in their middle order in a county game, right? Like, unless he could bowl at least 15 overs a day, right? That's how much he had changed. But, you know, those sorts of players are desperate to play and they love the game and they try and get, you know, I've done a podcast, Yashir, about Callum McLeod. He's probably the only one of these players I've talked to, but I might try and reach out to Mark Richardson one day as well. Colin Miller, I think, is slightly different because I think Colin Miller just got a little bit bored and come up with a party trick and it worked. I think some of the other ones I'm more interested in because they legitimately changed what they were doing to stay in the game. I don't think Colin Miller did it that way. It just happened to be that when he did it exploded. But there's still something within that Colin Miller. It's one of the reasons I'm so fascinated about Benny Howe, right? Benny Howe starts as a batter, bowls a little bit of shit medium pace. No one cares about it. And these days, who cares about his batting? Like, those sorts of players are so fascinating to me. Ben says, what happens when to whole test matches worth of footage after it's aired? Is it deleted? The Sky, for example, have every minute of the footage of England home test since 2016 saved somewhere. Depends on the broadcasters. A lot of them do not have it. We have just, you know, I've been doing this documentary with Channel 9 on the super tests, or not on the super tests, but on Packers cricket. It's terrifying to know how little cricket they have. And I know that's the case in other periods as well. Sometimes they don't know where they have it as well. Sometimes I think it was at the BBC. Was there a fire and they lost some? I think it was the BBC. I always mispronounce it, but it's DoorDashen. I think they threw out a bunch of their stuff, I want to say. But in the old days, a lot of it was just thrown away. Like, where do you store it? Like, especially when it was film and you know, the VHS tapes or the Betamax tapes, I would say probably in those days, again, they disappeared. So no, I don't know. Now it's all digitized. It's digitized instantly. So I don't know how far back that goes, but you know, companies like Sports Mechanics, MV Play, who we partner with, all these sorts of companies, they literally film everything. So even if everything is now stored, but that's like maybe the last 8 years. Before that, I don't think we have it that much, if I'm being honest. Ruja says, if Rohit, Virat and Pant all average 30 for the series, do India win narrowly? Don't know, because I'm more interested in the bowling at that point, Rudra. But yes, perhaps. I think the more fun one is like if they had two Sirajas or Akash Deep actually took wickets. Might be the more interesting ones there. But yes. Josh says, Sam Consis had some surprising success scooping Bumrah in the BGT. Which great pre-2000 bowlers would have been susceptible to this strategy? Well, we saw it happen to McGrath in his career, and that was, you know, early on in the scooping process, like Marillier. I've always been interested in how Garner would have handled it. So Garner's one that I think is quite interesting. But also I think in general, it's probably easier to scoop a skiddier bowler, isn't it? Is that fair? Yeah, I think that's right. I'd have to ask some cricketers who are scoopers, but I think it's probably easier to do a scoop. So maybe Malcolm Marshall, Lindwong, off the top of my head. They seem like ones that might be, but I don't know. You know, also the line hitting people off the line of length. So Kapil Dev, Richard Hadley would be two others that you'd probably want to do it to, right? I don't know how it would go with the outswing, the amount of outswing they both got. MF Jim says, throughout the series, India had support staff scattered around the boundary and fielding balls. Several times they stopped the ball, preventing the ball hitting them. I noticed this too, actually. I can't see anything in the third edition laws against this specifically, but is there a playing condition mentioning this? I don't know, but I thought the same thing. I thought it was quite interesting. It's like, I don't have an issue with it. Like, it makes sense. But I just wondered, because they were support staff and it was happening so often, that whether the ICC was interested in it at all. But yeah, I don't think what they were doing was wrong, as in there was a reason for them to do it that was like helping them. I can't think of any, except for over rates, right? If it's an over rate thing, then that's genius and well done to them. But it probably makes more sense to let the ball hit the padded triangle. The issue with that is that when it hits a padded triangle, if you've ever been in a place with one, it's very hard to get the ball coming, you know, it's hard to pick it up. It actually makes more sense to do this, but it'd be interesting to see if there is a crackdown, because I have seen it before, but I don't think I'd ever seen it as much as I saw India do it. Naveen says, did India overbowl Bumrah in the series, especially when they had Washi and Jadeja in the team? If they're going to play Washi, hardly have him bowl, bat him at number 8, could they have gone with a pure batter? I think they see Washi. Oh, I think he was the left-hander that they wanted in that number 8 position. Putting a pure batter at number 8 is really tricky, man, because it fucks with their heads. You know, it's a very tricky thing. Yeah, I don't think they underbowled Washington or Jadeja, considering the conditions. I think at a certain point, they had to make a calculated decision to just have less batting at the number 8 position and have an extra seamer. I'm just not sure that they felt confident enough in any of their backup seamers to do that and think it was going to have an impact. I think that's as simple as what we saw. James says, is there a worse fandom in cricket than Kohli stands? I get that he's done great things, but commenting King Kohli, etc. on unrelated cricket posts or even on players' relatives' posts is idiotic. And I've only been on the internet since Virat's only form was gully cricket. Oh, okay. I mean, all those obsessive fandoms. You know, when I first saw it come into cricket, I kind of saw it more in the... It happened with Kohli, but I didn't notice it as much with Kohli because it was Indians who liked Kohli, right? But the AB de Villiers and the Kane Williamsons, they both had really rabid fan bases. And it was the same sort of stuff. I think the Kohli and the Rohit one and the Babar Azam, I would throw that in there as well, were the ones where you just can't have a conversation. But I think that's more modern sports things. And I don't want to have a go at Kohli's fans specifically for that. because I think, James, that it would be the same with Ronaldo versus Messi fans, right? Do you know what I mean? I just think that's where sport has gone, where you identify with a player and they become your, that becomes your personality. And as someone who doesn't see cricket in that way, I find it tedious and boring. But I don't know if I find that more tedious and boring than like any other, like, you know, you're having a cricket conversation about something that's completely a niche topic and then random fans bring their teams and views into it. Like, it's just as boring. But yeah, Rohit, Bubba and Virat was certainly got to a point where we did a whole podcast on the Bubba one, because I think everyone knew about the Rohit and the Virat one, but we were really interested in the Bubba one. And because I had Bayram. In fact, I think it might've been before I hired him. It was one of my test things. If he could handle that, I kind of felt like he could handle anything. And he did brilliantly in that podcast. And then we got attacked for days by Bubba fans, right? A lot of them have gone quiet. and that's the other thing, isn't it? The Collie fans aren't anywhere near what they used to be before. It was way worse in those sort of peak days. I think it's just changing sports fandom. And if you're not from that culture of like putting the player above, and I've been lucky enough, of course, to, as a basketball fan, I kind of went through that. As a tennis person, I kind of saw the Federer one happen as well. It's happened, and I noticed the Messi Ronaldo one so much so that when it pivoted to cricket, I could see the same pattern straight away. You know, so I just think that's that modern fandom, and I think that was going to great for a lot of people because it, yeah, it's not ideal, is it? MF Jim says a rogue selection for the Sri Lanka versus Australia series could be Cooper Connolly. He's shown some very mature batting this year in both the Shield and the Big Bash. Also bowls some handy left arm spin, where I think that if he's turning it square, he's probably especially equally as good as Kuderman. Oh, I do not. I'm not a big fan of Cooper Connolly's bowling, so I might be the wrong person to ask for this. I kind of like him as a batter. I'm interested in him as a batter, I should say. I don't like him particularly as a bowler. Most of the stuff I've seen him bowling in, though, is limited overs. So I don't want to like say, oh, he's never going to be a bowler or anything like that. I wouldn't be picking him for that. I would prefer they went with Kuhneman. I like Bo Webster is an interesting choice now because he gives you a little bit of that. So they got Kuhneman, they got Bo Webster. They'll have Murphy if they want to take him over or a wrist spinner, and they have Lyon. I think they're okay. I don't really see Cooper Connolly. Like, I just think that this is what Kuhneman has been waiting for, and this is what you have been preparing him for. It just seems like a mistake to me to not use him that way. Ditian says, you've really got me obsessed with Sun on Our Own. I'm glad. I went and looked at videos of him bowling his knuckle carom balls. Looks like he is flicking the ball with two fingers, middle and index, different from Ashwin's only middle. But what do you mean he's swinging the ball out with his knuckleball instead of spin? So if you look really early on in the games, he's quite often, he's bowling sort of like a traditional arm ball, but he's hiding it in a way. And he's also sometimes bowling it with the knuckleball grip. So he's basically doing what Benny Howe worked out, which is a knuckleball is really good, but over a certain period of time, the problem with a knuckleball is people are getting more used to facing it. And once they realize the ball's not rotating, they can do it. If the ball's not rotating and that's the first thing that your brain clicks in and it's swinging, you've got an advantage. And so what Sun on Our Own has done is he's worked out how to bowl the knuckleball in such a way that it swings. And so he has two clear advantages. And also, he's also worked out what Akhil Hasan has worked out, which is you can swing the ball either into left-hander or into the right-hander, and you can cramp up the player, and they don't have time to sort of give themselves room to be able to do that. So I hope that sort of helps. But yeah, as far as the knuckleball demo, for those listening, he's just holding it like a normal outswing bowler, but with the knuckleball grip. And sometimes he can do the in-swing as well. As I said, I've seen him swing the ball both ways. He's not as good as Akhil Hasan is with it, but he can do it. And we're starting to see more and more bowlers, as spinners, try that as a method. We haven't done it. We might do it for the IPL. It might even be the Champions Trophy, but the IPL probably makes more sense. But there's a bunch of cool old cricket tricks that are coming back because of T20 cricket. Arm balls for spinners, leg cutters for seamers, There's another one that is on my board and I can't see it from here. Leg cutters for seamers. And there was something else. Yeah. Anyway, I've got a list of them down. I think it's really fascinating that some of those old tricks are coming back. All right. Well, I'm well over time already. So what I'll do is just see if there's any super chats. And there is a million super chats. So let me get this other comment off, which I, of course, have forgotten to take off. And then I run through as many super chats as we have. Virginia says, finally got myself to read your pieces on Good Areas. And I was wondering, what is the research process you follow, where you get your data, and how you get the ideas you do? Also love the Pakistan t-shirt. It's not a t-shirt, it's a jumper. Genius. Big fan of cricket jumpers. I've just become a big fan of cricket jumpers, and I found this one randomly. So I got the West Indies one and the Pakistan one. I think they're both all vintage or something. But I'm a big fan of cricket jumpers. I also bought a Worcester jumper, or two Worcester jumpers, and both the boys stole them because I liked them so much. Now, Muku, why is my producer? This isn't a sponsor, Muku. Muku's trying to get a sponsor thing. I literally bought this off Vinted, but the guy had heaps of them. So if you put in Pakistan cricket shirts on Vinted in the UK at the moment, this guy was selling loads of them. Eek's got one as well. Can I have the comment back, though? All right, okay. What is the research process you follow? Look, I've done a whole course on this, Genius, and so it's worth having a look at that. There is no one way I do anything. It's just if something tickles me, I will look into it and I will look into it and that will be the research. And then from there, I try and structure how the piece should work, what style I'm going to do it in, how these days, how I'm going to process it on video, you know, who I might need to talk to, all these different things. And I go through it. The ideas for me, I think ideas come to me every single day, right? And it's about noting them down and writing them on my whiteboard or putting them in my phone or wherever I need to go. The data, we get it from so many different places. Obviously, MVPlay have been really helpful to us. Andrew Sampson with his stuff. But we get it from like Jimenez with his stuff. We get data from all these different places. It comes from what I'm interested in. It's why I get really shitty when people go, oh, you're just doing videos on this or whatever. It's like, yeah, I'm just doing videos on things I'm interested in on this day. Right? Like that's how this channel has, or both our channels have always worked. Where are we? Rohit says, I'll talk about how star culture is a rot in Indian cricket. How to end this. As an Indian, it breaks my heart seeing Indian player versus Indian player wars. Has IPL enhanced it? Yeah, I think IPL has enhanced it. I think it was always there in Indian culture. It happens in all sports, but the difference is here, Rohit, that LeBron and Steph Curry only have to play with each other like once every 4 years. And they're pretty excited to do that. And, you know, they're fine. But yeah, it's a pretty, I mean, you know, as a Denver Nuggets fan and, you know, watching a lot of Philadelphia 76ers, like that Embiid Joker contest became so toxic, right? Like it became racist. Like it just lost its mind, right? And all these people like who have, you know, Embiid or Joker as their personality, as I was saying before, it lost its mind. I think in India, I get the feeling it's always been there. You know, I don't want to go down the Harsha Bogle, we have many gods theory, but I can understand why that is also an issue. Does it happen in every other sport? It's happening in every sport at the moment. And so weirdly enough, I reckon India was almost ahead of the curve on this compared to some other places. So I don't know how you stop it. It seems to be now that you don't necessarily grow up and follow your local team anymore. You kind of follow the star player you like, and then you ride and die with that player. And it's just, as I said before, it's a very different way of supporting sport. Samit says, why the disrespect for South Africa from the World Test Championship final from certain sections? They didn't make the draw. They've won the last seven, including a clean sweep in Bangladesh. Yeah, once they won in Bangladesh, I kind of felt it was a bit shitty. Bangladesh have been playing some really good cricket at home and some really good cricket. I know they fucked up when they got to India and didn't play as well as they should have in the West Indies either. But I think that's fair. I think that was a really good win from South Africa and the way they played over there. The disrespect is because it's one of those things of like, people like to moan about things after the truth is we've always known that it's a flawed system and that some of the other teams are going to slip in sometimes when they may not be in the top two best sides. I think it's fair to say South Africa's not in the top two best sides in the world. Like, and I'm a, you know, and I've been a huge defender of them having a great bowling attack. And now they've got a batting lineup. Maybe they've slipped into the top two. But I don't think they've been in the top two in the last 2 years. They also made it worse for themselves to me when they took off a series in the middle of it. Like, you know, that's weird, right? Following up, Vereen, best of this world so far. Follow-up one, Vereen. I don't know what that follow-up is. Best of the world test. It's like, oh, okay, I'd have to look at the numbers. Projections on Mapaka. Mapaka's interesting. I watch a lot of his domestic stuff. He's not a wobble ball bowler, which I find interesting. He swings it, but he also falls away. And then he has the short balls to go back to later on, the sort of skiddy, nasty short balls. And obviously he's doing all this at high pace. I feel like he's one tool away from being a great bowler, but he's got plenty of time to learn it. And because he's got so many other good skills to him, I think what he's going to do is he's going to swing the ball back early, then he's going to slant it across like an old-fashioned left-arm bowler. We don't see many of them anymore. He can then bowl around the wicket, and because he skids it in, he keeps the stumps in play, and he can hit you with bounces. There's lots of little things there. I kind of want one other thing on him. Tempest pull conversion rate, I'm not too worried about that. Markram and the weak link of the batting. I think that's a really interesting thing with Markram late. I think someone else might have asked this question, and now I've already lost it. But, you know, is there a situation where he gets dropped, even though he's obviously in their top four most talented batters? And by a distance, he might just have to be. Like, imagine if Markram was playing for India at the moment, right? Or England. Those two teams, like, those medias would savage him, and he gets some bad press, but South African press, cricket press isn't the same, right? Ikan says, what were Don Bradman's technical weaknesses? Ones that reported and ones that you'd imagine were to have been the case. Well, he played across the line. He's I suppose, technical weakness, but also his strength. He played back to the spinners quite a bit. So I think in an era where you had faster spinners, he might have got found out a little bit more with the ball skidding through. What's the other one I'm missing here? Back to the spinners. Oh, and obviously the short ball, which is the most reported one, right? I think genuine fast bowling bothered him a little bit. There weren't that many fast bowlers, and I suppose you could say that's the case with a vast majority of players. But I think genuine fast bowling and short pitch bowling specifically bothered him. Ikan says, what makes a good editor in your experience? I think the biggest problem with editing is that we hire this job. It's a bit like coaching, good editing. We hire it based on how you write too often, rather than how you edit. And so what ends up happening is you end up with a writer who's frustrated they're not writing anymore, but they're getting paid a lot more than they ever did as a writer. And they kind of get involved in pieces in the wrong way. I don't know what quality of... I'm very good at certain parts of editing. And I think there are other parts I struggle with a little bit. But I'm very good at picking up if you haven't nailed the story, right? Like if the story structure is wrong, I can pick that up in a millisecond. So that's a really important one. I don't know how good I would be at understanding how other writers write their pieces sometimes. Like, it's hard for me because I write in such a distinctive way and it comes so naturally to me. And I wasn't trained. This is all, you know, a combination of whatever spectrums I'm on and the weird upbringing I had, you know, reading adults' books when I was, you know, very, very young, and, you know, reading screenplays when I got older, and all these different things that have made me who I am. It's very hard for me to sometimes see what the other person is trying to do. But yeah, I think it's someone who can understand why the writer is writing the way they are and can say to them, okay, would this make it better? And it's almost like, I think a great editor is probably like a great film director. And there aren't many great editors, sadly. But I think at their very best, what they can do is they can say, I can see what you're trying to make here as the actors and the screenwriter and the cinematographer. But I think the overall vibe of this should be this. And how do we get this piece there? And I think that's something that we have seen at times people, editors, really struggle with. The issue is that this is such a sad question because there are no editors left. Like, you know, no one really does any editing anymore. If I work for someone, it's very rare that I get proper notes on anything. And the people who do give notes quite often aren't qualified to give the notes. So the notes aren't really of that much use. So, it's a bit of a shame, but yeah, what makes an editor good is someone who understands what it will take to make you the best writer that you can be. And that there's almost no time for that in modern culture. Jack says, batter top edges the ball from a spinner, which lobs up and is heading for the stumps on its way down. Can the batter swat the ball away to protect the stumps? Or will they be given out for obstruction? I'm not an umpire. There's a bunch of really good umpiring TikToks and Instagram accounts that talk about all these sorts of things. That is worth asking those sorts of things too. If you are trying to protect your stumps, I think you're allowed to do that, but it's probably within the realms of, like, if the wicketkeeper's hands are coming there and you're swinging directly at the hands, there might be an element of obstructing there. But yeah, you're much better off asking the umpiring experts on that sort of one. If that happens in a game, I would go and read the laws. Shrikant says, does Presley Krishna remind you of Shane Bond? There's a little bit in his action, I suppose. Very different kinds of bowlers. So there's nothing really within their bowling once the ball has left their hands that he reminds me of Shane Bond. But there's probably a little bit in his action that is slightly similar to the way that Shane Bond bowled, I would say. But yes, very different kinds of bowlers. And also, Shane Bond probably doesn't get remembered this way, but he was an incredibly smart bowler. I haven't seen that from Prashant Krishna yet. And he's 28. Like, I'm not saying he can't be a good bowler. I don't think we're ever going to look back on him and be like, oh, he was a genius bowler or anything like that. I think that's me done. So many chats on the Patreon today. So sorry, I couldn't get to any normal ones there. Also, I just want to make sure. So Arb sent through a super thing, but I don't see a question from Arb here. So I don't know if he didn't get on. But there you go, Arb. You're on the screen. Thank you very much to everyone. Oh, yeah. TSC says, happy birthday, Jack. How do people know it's my birthday? I don't understand that. The internet's a weird thing. All right. But I am Jared Kimber. It is my birthday. But thank you to everyone for your support. And I'll see you again very, very soon for, you know, all of more of this, more of me talking about cricket and other things. Oh, wait, Shrikant. Oh, of course. Is Steve Smith the greatest first innings batter of all time, barring Bradman? I think, is it Lara or Everton Weeks? Also has a similar record to Steve Smith. But yeah, I think there's three of them and Bradman. Bradman was really good at cricket, everyone.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.